We're focusing all of our resources at the end and very little at the beginning, at the prevention, at the upstream. And so all you need to do is look at Denmark and other Scandinavian countries. Even the US has a lot more than we have in the prevention side of things.
That was Lisa Levin, CEO of Advantage Ontario. In this episode, we chat with Lisa about how Advantage Ontario advocates for seniors' quality of life, housing policy that promotes aging in place, and what other countries are doing to innovate how we age.
Hi, I'm Xian Xiao.
And I'm Sammy Winemaker. We talk to people who have information and tips on how to unlock a better illness experience.
The waiting room revolution starts right now.
Okay, well, Lisa, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Shannon and Sammy. I am so excited to be here with you both.
It's so good to meet you.
So, Lisa, you are the CEO of Advantage Ontario. Can you tell us a bit about what Advantage Ontario does?
Absolutely. So we've been around for over 100 years. So we're senior citizens ourselves. And we've gone through many iterations over time. But basically, we are the only association in Canada that represents the full continuum of care of seniors. And we have over 500 full members that provide that are all nonprofit or municipal. And they provide seniors long-term care, seniors housing, and community services. Many of them have campuses of care. Many of them represent different cultural groups. And so they're all over Ontario. And what we do for them is we advocate to government on their behalf. And there certainly has been no end of things to advocate for. And we also provide other supports and education and training. We have a very extensive education curriculum that I would encourage your listeners to check out on our website, advantageontario.com, under resources. A lot of it is virtual and available on demand. And so it's a really fantastic job because we're focused on the full continuum of care for seniors.
What does that mean, full continuum of care?
That's a great question, Sammy. So a lot of people just look at one piece or another. Actually, I shouldn't say people, I should say government. People look at the full continuum. So so some individuals, okay, look at long-term care and say, okay, that's the answer. But we know that people want to stay at home as long as possible. And so the beginning of the continuum is living at home independently. And then having a little bit of support coming in would be the next stage. So perhaps you have someone to help with light housekeeping or to help you with a bath. And then as you go through, you can go to other forms of seniors housing. It could be retirement housing, but not everyone could afford that. So then you could have assisted living options. You could have co-housing, group housing, and things like that. And then you can get more into the long-term care side of things, slow stream rehabilitation, and then hospital.
Yeah. Sian and I were driving somewhere and I was saying, Sian, do you know the difference between a retirement home and a long-term care facility? And I gave him the whole spiel, but yeah, so that's what you mean by you, when you say full continuum, it's everywhere.
Well, it includes day programs, transportation programs, friendly visitors. And actually, Sammy, a lot of people have that question, and I'm doing a webinar with CARP Ottawa at the end of March on what the difference is between retirement housing and long-term care, because most people do not know. Physicians do not know the difference between the two.
And there's huge implications. They are completely, well, they're very different. And as you may or may not know, I make home visits and I care for people in their home, but that can also be a retirement home or a group home, or I go also go into long-term care. And, you know, I have to really understand that care setting to, you know, to make a plan, because it varies in terms of professional staff versus non-professional staff. The role of the family or not, you know, what medications you can give, like the skill, the environment and culture in terms of how do they see a person living there until the end of their life, and how have they prepared for that? Like, there's so many differences, financial differences. But you're right. Like, no, most people lump them all together.
Most people lump them together, and retirement housing gets no money from the government, whereas long-term care does. But long-term care homes could be run by for-profit entities or not-for-profit entities or municipal entities. And retirement housing is typically run by private companies, but there are a few not-for-profit retirement homes.
Yeah. So, Lisa, you and I know each other from work that we have done for palliative care. And so I'm just curious, you know, how does that word palliative care land, and how does that fit in with some of the role that you do and some of the work that you're doing? Recognizing that I know we both believe that palliative care is not just end of life care, but sort of across the continuum of an illness.
So what strikes me is that I've done advocacy in the palliative care area for many, many years, and we continue to be a death denying society where people think palliative care equals end of life care. And there's been very little change socially in that area, which is disappointing, although resources have increased somewhat over the years. And when people hear the concept, I find they often approach it with fear and without understanding that it actually can improve people's health outcomes, having a palliative approach to care. So I believe a lot more needs to be done to normalize that conversation and have it really something that I think the primary care physician should be dealing with earlier on in people's healthcare experience, but certainly something that needs to be done in the long-term care setting at the very least, with the average length of stay being 18 days by definition. Many long-term care residents are palliative, not all, but many. But it should really be done a lot earlier than that.
Lisa, did you mean 18 months, not days?
Did I say days?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think you were thinking of hospice.
Yeah, really? No, even that's long. No, thank you for clarifying. 18 months. And yes. Actually, it's gotten shorter with the new changes the government has made.
Sometimes I refer to long-term care settings as long-term hospices.
Yes, and since Bill 7, sometimes people are coming into long-term care and they're dying within days.
Wow.
Which is deeply, deeply concerning that people are being moved in such a fragile state.
Yeah. I mean, it's so important what you're doing in thinking of, you know, the policy pieces of where people live and all the factors around it. As you know, in our work, The Waiting Room Revolution, we are trying to provide information to patients and families earlier in the illness journey. And I know you've read our book. And so what are your thoughts? Like, do you think that our work has a piece in trying to make the experience better?
I think your work is amazing, and it should be necessary reading for everyone who's having a serious medical condition, because it helps empower you, the patient, at a time where you really feel powerless, because you're often waiting for diagnostic tests. You're in a giant lineup all the time, trying to get through to the doctor's office, sitting in a chemo ward, lined up against the wall, waiting for your turn. It's quite, not intentionally, but it could be quite dehumanizing, certainly very scary. And I am definitely recommending it to my friends, and something I have on my shelf if I were to ever need it. And I took a family member through a stage 4 cancer diagnosis, and it would have been helpful to have had it then.
Well, it's always wonderful to hear if it's been helpful from someone who's read it, especially someone with your perspective and all your knowledge and experience with seniors. Sometimes people wonder what role does this kind of, let's just call it a palliative approach to care, have with just people getting older, where they might not have one overriding diagnosis that's, you know, snowballing ahead. you know, some illnesses declare themselves, and it's easier to identify when, you know, the care is shifting. But when you have a person just aging, sometimes it's more nebulous. You know, when do we start preparing? When do we start thinking about a palliative approach?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And mm-hmm. certainly it's been somewhat easier to implement it with cancer mm-hmm. Patients. And when someone is, quote unquote, just getting older and have multiple comorbidities and different chronic illnesses, they just become frailer and frailer over time and have exacerbations, but then they rally mm-hmm. and they come back. And mm-hmm. it's this long journey.
Yeah.
I don't know when someone should be defined palliative. That is beyond my expertise. I'm not a clinician, but I think the conversation needs to be a basic one that people have. Just as you know, once you have, if you have children, you talk about getting life insurance. Mm-hmm. People, many of them do have wills, and mm-hmm. it should be part of that conversation. The advanced care planning should be the, mm-hmm. you know, a joint piece to it. You know, what are your wishes? And of course, that needs to be refreshed and updated, because when you're very young and vibrant, you might be like, I'd rather be dead than have blah, blah, blah happen to me. And then you get yeah. to blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, well, I'm not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. But I think that as a society, we need to think of these things much earlier. Mm-hmm. And they are inevitable. We are all going to die. And mm-hmm. so let's try and do the, you know, have our wishes in place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I mean, that it's not a guessing game.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a good point. And in many ways, like the start of our whole work, our movement was this idea of people not knowing what they didn't know and people saying to us, I wish I had known that sooner. And so I wonder mm-hmm. if I asked you that question, like, what do you often hear that people wish they had known sooner about aging and preparing for some of these supports? Like what do you want listeners to know? Hey, if there was some advice that you had or things that you often see, what advice would you have that you wish
well,
people
I guess,
knew? Yeah,
sorry, go ahead. I guess it's just to say, don't just leave it. Like you really need to plan for death the way you plan for life. And it's really important to think about what you want in different scenarios. And it's also not fair to your children, if you have children, to put it on them to try and figure out what you may want. Be open to these conversations. It's hard for children to have these conversations with their parents. Mm-hmm. And it should be an open conversation. I've already told my children some of my wishes of mm-hmm. things that I would like based on the way I think I'm going to end up going, given how the rest of my family has. And, you know, my daughter wants to put together a playlist of music and, you know, all kinds of stuff. But she's like, Mommy, what kind of music do you like? Because I said to her, I want to be surrounded by dogs and music.
Yeah.
That's what I want. But yeah, we have to have these difficult conversations, and we need to find a way to be able to access them and normalize them. And there may be more of an appetite than we think, but people don't know where to go. Like the average person doesn't know where to go to have these conversations. And I know in some societies, they have death cafes. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's a bit of a morbid thing, but some kind of way to have these conversations,
yeah,
woven into our society would mm-hmm. be helpful.
Yeah, because I'm just reflecting on the fact that Sienna and I always talk about, you know, that we want to improve the illness experience from the time of diagnosis. But if you are just plain old aging with a little bit of X, Y, and Z, it's hard to know, you know, where is that beginning? It's more nebulous, as we said, and so people get older and they start requiring help with things that they used to be able to do, and their mobility changes, and maybe things slow down eventually, but there's no beginning of it. It comes in like a light fog, aging. And so I think that's what makes it a little bit more tricky, to know when to raise questions. So it's probably, again, something we need to infuse into the normal conversations as we live our lives, as we experience other people's illnesses or other people's deaths, or, you know, that we just start to begin to have higher mortality awareness as a population, so that when we get older, we will not be death denying, like you said. Like, we just need to, our society needs to change, the culture of all of our lives eventually coming to the end needs to change, so that we normalize it, right?
Sure. So there's lots of seminars, for example, on retirement planning.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe it could be part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're right. There is no necessary obvious beginning of the decline. But why does there need to be? If you already sort of have your plan, and I mean, I think there, as part of the annual exam with a doctor, mm-hmm. there should be a check-in with people's goals and wishes, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, leads to the whole conversation of the lack of integration between primary care and home and community care, mm-hmm. and the need for that, because the two are separated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we really need to combine them, so mm-hmm. that when someone goes to their family physician and it's clear that they need some support, the family physician can say, well, why don't you make an appointment with Amy? She's our navigator. She comes mm-hmm. in Mondays and Wednesdays and Thursdays, and she can do a phone call with you and have an OT come out and look at your mm-hmm. home, or whatever it is. Like, that needs to be part of it, as opposed to a other place you go mm-hmm. whose name changes every year, CCAC, mm-hmm. LIN, HCCSS, Ontario Health at Home. Like, how many times are they going to change the name of that agency? And make it part and integrated into people's journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know we're talking about sort of, you know, the dying part, but so much of what Advantage Ontario does is help people age well and age in place. And so I wonder if, I mean, we sometimes get this question about the magic wand question, but what are some of your, you know, if you could wave a magic wand, what are some of the things that you wish, maybe policy-wise, that could happen? Or maybe not policy-wise, maybe just society-wise, that would make aging in place and aging well happen better? Like, what are we missing?
We're focusing all of our resources at the end and mm-hmm. very little at the beginning, at the prevention, at the upstream.
Mm-hmm.
And so all you need to do is look at Denmark and other Scandinavian countries. Even the US has a lot more than we have in the prevention side of things. Mm-hmm. We need to properly fund and provide a robust array of seniors, community services and social supports, proper home care, proper escorted transportation to day programs that don't require mm-hmm. a copay, which is a barrier, Meals on Wheels mm-hmm. that don't require a copay, ability to get home care if you just need a bath three mm-hmm. times a week and some light housekeeping. Mm-hmm. So that will prevent you from falling on the mat that's in the middle of your room mm-hmm. and breaking your hip and ending up in the hospital. We need to take all of the seniors not-for-profit housing in Ontario, where there's a lot of units, I don't know the exact number, and put a social navigator in each building. That will turn it into supportive housing, affordable supportive housing, where you can bring people and link them in to the activities and supports that they need. Take away the isolation, which is so damaging to their health, that we've known about studies that have said it, and we've seen it during COVID. We need to have slow stream rehab for seniors, so that if they have some kind of adverse event or exacerbation in the hospital and they become deconditioned and go into delirium, that they can have rehabilitation back to a level of baseline that they can go home and not end up in long-term care because there's no other place for them. So we need to really refocus and reshift our systems, because our hospital and healthcare system was based on a healthy population of baby boomers who were 20s and 30s and younger, and now we're aging.
I'm not. Just kidding. I'm kidding. I just thought I'd throw that in. Sometimes I say everyone's going to die except me. Just kidding.
That's true. Yeah, yeah. Right. Well, because I don't know about you, but I'm the most important person in the world.
Yeah, me too.
So like, it couldn't go on without me.
But you raise so many areas that require change and reform. And it sounds so straightforward when you talk about it, Lisa.
So it's also a lot cheaper, Sammy.
Yeah, I know.
And it's what people want.
Exactly. If we could just change the direction of this boat called healthcare and start looking more at public health and prevention and all those things that you mentioned, boy, would people be healthier, feel better, get what they want, like you said, and we would save so much money in the healthcare system for sure.
So why
I vote for you.
Yeah. Yeah. We sometimes get this question. So why is it not happening from your experience, from the advocacy? Like, what are some of the barriers that prevent us from really investing more in community and social supports, right? Really, that's taking away the emphasis from acute hospital driven care to supports in the community, social connection.
I don't know. It's like this crazy inertia. And we're finally starting to get some support. And Ontario Health has just put out their strategy map, and we had them in our webinar with our members yesterday. And there's a big focus in there in upstream and prevention, which I was so excited to see. You should check out their website. So they're talking about it. They're starting to talk about it, but then we're coming up to an election, and, you know, will whoever the next government is, either this or another one, continue talking about it or get waylaid by something else. But we cannot afford to keep the system the way it is. And there is no capacity to keep the system the way it is. And it's impacting people now of all ages because people can't get into a hospital bed. So I don't know why not, but we are certainly trying to make it our business to see some changes come through. And I think it will happen. It's just hopefully won't be too little too late.
I wonder if part of it is what I experience out here working in the community is just that there is no bricks and mortar, and there is no one person responsible for all the care out here. We have a patchwork or a quilt, whatever you want to call it, of different services. And yes, we have home care, and you know, they have a certain scope, but it's not all encompassing. And so the community is like the Wild West of the healthcare system. And we do not train all healthcare providers to understand the community healthcare sector. So they worry themselves more about what happens in the hospital. And, you know, long-term care has had some recent spotlight, of course, because through COVID. But this community sector really does not, it's too unorganized. There's no one agency responsible for connecting all the dots in the community. So I just think it's a hodgepodge.
Well, there is an agency called HCCSS that's going to be called Ontario Health at Home, but yeah. People don't know who they are. And so that's why I said, if we can embed it as part of the primary care experience.
Yeah, I agree.
We have navigators.
But yes, definitely navigation is huge, but they don't deal with some of the other stuff that you're talking about, like the isolation and the transportation. And so home care deals with, you know, certain services in people's home, like visiting nursing, PSW, some equipment, some care coordination, But that's just even a small piece of what you're talking about in terms of the whole suite of or yeah. menu of things that should be available to seniors.
Well, technically, they are supposed to lead people to those services. And there's been so much change that I guess they're not, but and maybe some are and some aren't. But by having navigation that is embedded throughout the primary care system, and having experts, they can make that information available to people and help them. And I know that the Ontario health teams that are being set up have been asked to do some work with navigation. But my question is will it be about community supports or will it all be about hospital? And so that's the kind of thing that we really need to look at. And they're also very focused with the OHTs on transforming home care. But what does that mean? And will all the oxygen sort of go into that piece?
Yeah. Hey, listeners, you're halfway through the episode. We want to remind you that our book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest, is available everywhere you buy books, in softcover, audiobook, and ebook. And did you know you can leave a review on Amazon without purchasing directly from Amazon? All you need is an account. And reviews help others find our book when they need it the most. So thanks for your support, and there's lots more to this great episode, so keep listening. I know I've asked a couple policy questions, but I hope if it's okay if I sort of turn it to more about, you know, I guess a personal question. But I mean, usually we find that people go into this work with personal experiences. And so I'm just wondering if you've had personal experiences that have impacted your career to work with seniors and work for advocacy and this intersection for palliative care.
So both my parents worked at the local long-term care home in our area as volunteers. Well, I know, I think my father was on staff, but and my mother did a lot of volunteer work in the community. When I was growing up, she started off doing Meals on Wheels. So I definitely got raised in the environment of it's important to give back and contribute to the community. And I was always surrounded by seniors because I had a great grandmother and she had many children, and every Sunday we all got together, and I spent a lot of time with the older folks in our family and developed an appreciation for that. And so I guess that has definitely helped with my interest. And then my grandmother got sick and died in an ICU in bright lights, completely tortured, you know, with a tube down her throat, not sedated properly. And that really impacted me. And then when I started doing work with palliative care, it's like, okay, well, this is not the way it can go. This is not the way someone should die. And then I also had the experience where my ex-husband was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and I had 2 teenage children, and it was incredibly difficult. He was sick for many years and he overcame it. But it was a very, very tough time. And I remember when he first told me he had cancer, I was on my way to a meeting about palliative care. And I, of course, turned the car around to go home, and I thought three things. First of all, his diagnosis was preventable if he had screening. So the first is, you're an idiot. Second, this is horrible, my poor children. And third, I'm going to be able to make a difference. Because whatever I learn through this, I'm going to make a difference.
Wow. Thank you very
much. Your parents would be proud, Lisa.
Can I just follow up on something you said? Because you also said that you had a best friend who had breast cancer, and you had wished, it sounds like it wasn't all smooth sailing. So what were the parts of the journey where you...
I don't think she said that, Sian.
Did you not? Am I getting... No. Okay. That's I thought really you said weird. You read our book and... I'm losing it. You did read our book, and I thought you said, I wish I had had this book when
she
went through this journey. I'm going, listen.
No, Although there is someone I wished I had given it to and it had been available a number of years ago.
Ah, yes, yes, a number of years
but
ago.
But it wasn't a
okay,
breast
never,
cancer.
Yeah, sorry, that's my journey creeping in there. So wait, but what was it about that journey, like that part of the journey where you're sort of, I guess, what was it? What are the hard parts of the journey that you were sort of like, if I had known that sooner, maybe never, you know what? Scrap this.
It's okay.
Late in the day.
I think what you're saying, Sian, is knowing that Lisa has read the book. You have, right, Lisa?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she mentioned
somewhere over here.
And she mentioned that she knew someone that it could have been helpful for. That you're wondering, what was it about their situation that Lisa felt that the book might be helpful?
I just feel like when people go into the sort of hospital assembly line, they feel they lose control and they have no control. And so I believe, and really you do.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and a big part of coping is, I would just say, I'm now on a roller coaster. I'm strapping myself in and
do what you happening. Want with me.
Yeah, like it's happening, right? Like, but I think it really helps not being negative and saying whatever happens, happens. It helps to have the courage to ask the questions.
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone has that or think they have the ability to.
Mm-hmm.
And some people, that's just their nature.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in complete denial.
Mm-hmm.
Till the end. But I think this gives people the ability to feel more empowered, to be able to ask questions,
mm-hmm.
and make plans for what they can.
Mm-hmm. And people might choose not to, but the idea is that people should know that they can, and that they can change their own illness experience, even though they may not be able to change the illness itself, and that they have choices.
Yeah.
So this is why, you know, we try to position the book to reflect that there are some, I don't know what I'm trying to say now, Sian.
Well, there are some things that people can do.
Yeah.
Well, I find
give them control. Yeah. And choice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've seen a few examples of people who are, you know, we're battling this and we're going to get through mm-hmm. it. And, but they don't prepare themselves or their loved ones or their children or their spouses
mm-hmm.
for their death.
For the world. Mm-hmm.
Because maybe they're superstitious or they just don't want to think about it. And I don't know if that's wise.
Yeah. The aftermath of the people who are left is, it's harder.
And even for themselves, it's like, oh my God, I'm actually dying.
Yeah.
It's, people can't mm-hmm. accept it, and you don't want to accept it, but I think the experience is better if you no, it's a possibility. Well, certainly it's going to happen eventually, but
mm-hmm.
and just try and prepare yourself as best as mm-hmm. you can.
Yeah.
You know what? It's interesting because I can't remember who I was talking to recently, but they were reflecting on, oh, I know what it was. I was on someone else's podcast and the person was suggesting that we should probably consider generations when we think about how to approach certain things, and that she felt our book suited the baby boomer generation because they're likely to hold a book. They have, a certain type of relationship with the healthcare system and what they think of the doctor in their care. So there's all this course correcting that we do for the baby boomer generation who thinks a certain way about the doctor being on a pedestal. And, you know, you just act like a good patient, be polite, you know, be clean and dress presentable. Like there's just a baby boomer style, but that every generation, and I always forget the name of all of them, will have a different vibe, a different like cultural understanding based on their generation of how they see the healthcare, how they rely or not on having one doctor for their whole life. That's something, Sam, that you and I have not really talked about, right? Like this whole generational difference. But anyway, I go on and on about that. But I do think there is something there. I think that every generation will have a different culture about them, and that this book will mean a different thing to the different generations.
Yeah. And that's okay.
Yeah.
I think it's still an important resource, and perhaps other resources need to be considered to appeal to the different generations.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to make a change in behavior and attitude before people reach being seniors,
like my daughter will just text the doctor, or I say, you can't text the doctor. Oh, why? Like, what's your problem? Or, you know, if they see them on social media, just DM them. Like they're just way of looking at things is differently. My daughters go to the doctor for, oh, anyway, let's cut this out.
Steering. Lisa, you know, we've been talking a lot about some of the changes, mm-hmm. Or the gaps that we know exist. But are there examples of things that are going well that are exemplar models or programs that you think should be, you know, the shining light of where we should be scaling and spreading?
So in Denmark, when you turn 70, you get a nurse come to visit you every year and check out what your issues are, connect you up with a lot of education and resources, and they just sort of get you going in proactive preventative treatment. You can get up to something like 7 or 8 home care visits a day if you need it as your health deteriorates. And then at some point you may need to go into long-term care where you have a room with your own doorbell. And I was in the long-term care home there, and I see this doorbell and I'm like, are we in long-term care? And they're like, yeah. And there's so many issues that happen in long-term care with regard to sexuality or sexual relations. And in Denmark, you just do what you want. And because you have that doorbell, it's like your own place. I mean, obviously they need to protect you if something is going awry, but there's lots of huge ethical issues about consent and capacity and sexual activity in long-term care in Ontario and North America that is not an issue there. They call seniors, they call them citizens. So there's just a very different non-ageist approach to seniors. And it's fascinating. And with that really great slow stream rehab that they can offer. So that's an example of a system of care. They also have dementia villages in certain parts of Scandinavia. So you can go like shopping, even though you may have not have real money, even if you have dementia, you could feel like you're carrying out regular activities. There's small homes people live in, not big giant institutions, which makes it easier and more home-like. And I know there's a dementia village that is going up in BC, and certainly something that we need to look at in Canada. And then there's all the different emotional models of care in certain long-term care homes, like Butterfly Model is one, Eden Alternative. These are different kinds of homes where they focus on your emotional well-being as well as your physical well-being. Considering that over 70% of residents in long-term care have dementia, this is a really important way to approach things. And so there's wonderful models there. And then in terms of palliative care, we have exemplars like Kensington Health and Briere that have done some fantastic work. And Kensington also has a hospice, and they're now going out with their palliative care team to consult for other homes and explain to them how to provide palliative care in long-term care. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's certainly lots of innovative ideas. Another really great thing is the community wellness hubs that are springing up. And this is based on the US PACE model. So in Halton, they are region, they're really taking this very seriously, and they're trying to create a movement where you have seniors housing, social housing, and you put a navigator in there and you link people up to resources, mm-hmm. and you create this instant senior support of affordable housing with very little cost. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of really great models out there, but they're models, they're not throughout.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a little bit hopeful.
Yeah. I'm gonna, we know how to do it. Just give us the resources and it'll happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, have you ever looked, or how much do you know about the way Indigenous communities see and hold up their elders?
Well, like, elders are highly revered.
Yeah.
Which is a refreshing change from the ageism that we see a lot in our mm-hmm. rest of society. And so I've been out to some of our members that are Indigenous and met with the seniors, the elders, mm-hmm. who are the ones that advise them. And it's a very different way of doing things. And of course, the seniors, because they're so respected, it's a whole other way and a wonderful way to approach care.
The more I learn about Indigenous culture and life, the more I think to myself, oh, they know how to, they've got it right. They've been environmentalists and they've been, you know, respectful of their elders, and, you know, we could learn a lot from mm-hmm. our Indigenous communities.
But also many Asian cultures as well highly revere the seniors and see them as sages, and every culture is different.
Yeah. I'm going to change the topic just slightly, but I think I've heard you talk about this missing middle, and I think you're referring to the housing options. So I don't, if you can tell, what do you mean by the missing middle, and why is it challenging for seniors to age in place? And like, well, how's that gap going to affect that?
So in Ontario, people are living in their own private housing. And when they get older, maybe they don't need to be in such a large place, and it's up to them if, you know, they want to stay or not. But let's say they want to move out. Where are they going to go? They can go to a rental unit. They can go to retirement housing. They can get home care, private home care, if they can afford it. Many seniors in Ontario can't afford retirement housing, and many of them cannot afford private home care. So where does that leave those people? The lower and middle income people. And so the missing middle is what I call supportive housing, which is an affordable housing rental unit where you have some supports on site. You can have congregate dining, you can have a security check in the morning to make sure you're okay, social work support, social activities, transportation, recreation, mm-hmm. wellness, all of those things. So pretty much it's retirement housing for people who can't afford retirement housing. And that is the missing middle in Ontario. It is not rocket science, and it can be done without even building one more building. It could be done mm-hmm. by just providing the supports in the seniors' nonprofit buildings that exist and or rental rent controlled units that are like naturally occurring retirement communities.
We could learn a lot from the community paramedic programs, where they went to those buildings where there were a lot of what they would call, I guess, frequent flyers to the hospital, and they just sat in the lobby, and it made a huge difference for, people remaining at home. And what you're talking about is having like a navigator there too. It's cost effective, and it's what people want. But it's just not happening fast enough. Yeah. There's demonstration projects, but it's not being
taken up
nationally.
Society needs to change the way we orient ourselves. We are not senior friendly. I've heard, I'm not sure which grocery store it is, but there's a seniors line.
Oh, really? No. What's that about?
Well, do you ever get stuck behind the lady who's got everything in change and wants to have a conversation, and you feel really bad, but you're like in this huge hurry because you got to get home because you got to take your kid to their dance lesson or whatever it is. And so they have a seniors line. I forget which grocery store it is. I've heard about this, and where the seniors go and have a whole conversation. How was your day? And here, let me count out my change. And what's the weather like? And it's an interaction.
Slower. Yeah, it's relational. And
what about the airports? Do you have to pretend you're handicapped to get through an airport? Mm-hmm. I mean, oh my goodness, people should be able to travel. Like, we have got to change the giant lineups and whole approach to traveling. Like, there's just so many barriers. And with an aging population, we need to make changes.
So, my sister and I, sorry, Zian, always... Well, we're not really joking, but we say, you know, if we outlive our husbands and we can gather a few more women, we're going to buy something, a duplex or a whatever you buy, a small building, and we'll hire. Co-housing.
You hire someone to help, and you all.
Yeah. So are there examples of co-housing of
not a lot. I mean, it's starting, but we need to have examples. We need to have it encouraged. There was a Golden Girls bylaw that was passed to enable this because people thought there were rooming houses, or some municipalities didn't want it to happen. But those are the kinds of things that we need to, because the government can't fix everything and solve everything. And that can make a huge difference, because maybe one of your friends has mild dementia, but you keep her on her feet.
Yeah.
Boy, can she cook. And you have like severe tremors and you can't do that anymore. You know, so you coach her through the cooking, you know, you sort of
mix and match.
you create that enabling community where you and you support one another. And those are the kinds of things that we need to have happen.
Lisa, you're at the forefront of all these innovative ideas, you know, advocating for where the gaps are and also seeing all these great examples. So what gives you hope as you look forward to, gives you optimism and keeps you hopeful?
What gives me hope is that baby boomers have always changed the way things have been done. So let's change this. People don't want to go into institutions. People want to do things, they want to do things the way that they want to do it. So let's make change, and let's not just depend on the government. Let's let our voices rise. Let's speak out, and let's make our societies value and support seniors.
I vote for Lisa.
Me too.
I'm not running.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We learned so much.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe if you haven't already. Visit our website, waitingroomrevolution.com, for more information, to join our newsletter, and to check out our book, Vote for the Best, Plan for the Rest. This podcast is produced by myself, Kayla McMillan, Shilpa Jyothi Kumar, and Maggie Sivak. And our theme music is Maypole by Ketsa.